Good morning, Sid.
Morning.
Sid Strauss has been a longtime friend and colleague who has for many years been at Tel Aviv University, and in the summer he comes over and teaches at Tufts. What are you teaching?
Human development and learning.
Human development and learning, and we took advantage of Sid's visit here to Boston to invite him to come over and talk a bit about his history and the work he's been doing over the last years in the interface of developmental psychology and education. Your training, Sid, was where, when, and in what?
Let's see. The beginning was, I don't know where the beginning was, but I was in the sciences as an undergraduate student at the University of Illinois.
So you're American by birth?
Yeah. And actually, I got out of the sciences, and I think one of the reasons I got out of the sciences is one of the reasons I got into science education. I graduated high school, and I was a lot younger than most kids were. And so I had time to meander around the university, and I was in the sciences, and I thought at the time that one of the characteristics that separated the sciences from other fields was laboratory work. So when I was taking lab courses, I found myself completely bored. Qualitative analysis in chemistry, we were figuring out how to make a certain kind of materials. We weren't actually figuring out. We were told, do this, do that, do this, do that, and we were supposed to do that. I couldn't stand it, and I ended up trying to find ways to beat the system and to take parts out and see what happens if I could play around with it. But it wasn't interesting. But I thought that was science, because that was laboratory work. What I didn't understand was that was just the prerequisites to be able to do science. But since nobody really told us and I didn't quite figure it out, I thought it was terribly boring, so I just went on and started doing other things.
Well, since we're going to talk about science education, what would have been better to maintain your interest?
Well, I think one of the things for me would have been that just simply somebody would have pointed out what for them was very obvious, and to me as a young kid was very not obvious, and that is that we really weren't doing science. And what we were doing was something that would lead you to be able to do science. So that was a good start. If anybody had ever mentioned it, and I think I was not the only person who didn't catch up.
But what's doing science if it's not making chemicals and putting on Bunsen burners and
testing ideas?
Testing ideas.
And we weren't testing ideas. We were just doing recipe work, which was not very interesting. In fact, it was very not interesting. I just didn't catch on. Probably 99% of the people who were in the class as well didn't catch on. We thought we were doing science. We had no idea what science really was.
Of course, this raises the question of the difference between high school and the university, because I would guess that in more than a few science classes in high school, the teachers also think that that's what doing science is.
Oh, yeah.
Just like history, I mean, there's a big difference between high school or elementary school, where history is learning lots of information and chronologies and battles and treaties, and then instead of studying documents and taking perspectives and testimony and things like that.
Right. Yeah, there's also, there was really no discussion at all about the deep structure of the field, what knowledge is in the field, how you know what the knowledge is, what evidence is.
You know, Thomas Kuhn's book came out in 1962, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and it was second edition in 1970. And that's the most read serious paperback, next to the collected works of Jung and the Bible. And I think until that time, Americans in particular were very naive about the difference between science, technology, cookbooks, and so on. I think Kuhn's work was so dramatic in its perspectivism on science that I think it made those ideas more palpable for people who weren't practicing scientists.
Yeah, but what about the people who were practicing science? These were the faculty members who were doing it, and they were teaching us about
it. That's sad.
Yeah, and that was... I just I took off because it was, as I said.
Well, did you go right to psychology, or did or?
No, actually, I have no degrees in psychology.
No. Well, I think we'll terminate the interview at this point.
To my advantage in some ways, and to my disadvantage in others, I went to Berkeley. Actually, I was a teacher for a year in junior high school, teaching junior high school science in Hayward, California. Enjoyed it very much. But I looked around me. It was one of the few times I was really reflective and thinking about where I might want to go. And I looked around me and saw the amount of energy that I put into the work that I did, saw the other teachers, made an extrapolation where I might be 20 years down the line. And I asked myself, 20, 30 years down the line, I asked myself if that was the place where I wanted to go. And the answer was no. So I did the only other thing that I knew how to do, which was I decided to be a student again, and I went off and I did my PhD at Berkeley.
In
science education.
Okay.
And after the PhD, I did postdoctoral work in the psych department.
Science education means that you were preparing to be a teacher of science educators rather than a science teacher. Is that right?
Well, that's part of it.
And curriculum? Is this CARPLUS?
Yeah, right. I was working on the CARPLUS project for about 3 or 4 years in the biology section. The
so these are curricula for high school?
For elementary school.
Elementary school.
Right. Yeah, so I was working as a student. I was also working on CARPLUS's project. Mm-hmm. And but it's not just preparing science teachers to be science teachers. It's also trying to find out what science education can be about and what are the questions, hopefully the good questions to ask. How do children understand scientific concepts? What is the nature of cognitive change?
And this would have been just when people were reading not only Thomas Kuhn, but Jean Piaget.
Reading Piaget and reading Brunner. Because Brunner, in I think it was 1966, came out with his book, Studies in Cognitive Growth. And that was sort of in contrast to what Piaget was talking about, was trying to present.
Well, tell us about that. What was the contrast?
Piaget made claims that there are, universal cognitive structures that develop in a particular sequence. He tried to use logical mathematical models as ways to describe these mental structures. There was an inevitable running off of these structures, at least until the concrete operation stage. He had some problems with how do you go from a static description of a mental structure to how people actually behave. So I had to invent the idea of schemas as ways to get the system to act, to get the structure to do something above and beyond the assimilation and accommodation part. The social world was just used as a way to enhance the idea that he had that cognitive development, the main mechanism for cognitive development, was disequilibrium. So social of different types, and the social interactions were actually just formats in which disequilibrium can take place. Brunner came along, talked about different kind of representational systems. That was the frame that he was using. He was talking about, let's see if I can remember now, the iconic, the enactive, and the symbolic, I think, is what it was. But he used, he had the concept of culture in there, which for Piaget was basically out. Even though today people are, so the apologists of the Piagetian types are saying, well, Piaget also talked about culture, also talked about social interaction. He talked about everything, wrote about everything. The question is, how important was it for him? I think not very important, whereas Brunner, maybe being influenced somewhat by Vygotsky, had written about the influence of culture, cultural amplifiers, and things of that sort. Actually, my PhD thesis was a comparison between Piaget and Brunner. Actually,
what year was that?
1967.
So this is right after Brunner wrote the book, which he both dedicated to Piaget, but used as a way of hitting Piaget over the head.
And right.
they were estranged for a while.
Very Jewish. Very Israeli. Very nice things. And so, the work...
We should record that this interview is taking place on July 18th, 2000, one day before the nth summit meeting at Camp David between Barak and Arafat.
Right, exactly. So that was certainly what I was thinking about when I said that. One of the things that interested me was there was one particular set of studies that Bruner did, which was, I thought, the best set of studies that were supposed to make this point. And it was all, it was very messy.
Is that why you have these cups here?
Yeah, well, actually, no. That's for something else. And anyway, so I thought there was a lot wrong in the way that he had done the work. So I did sort of a replication study.
What was the general?
The general
envelope of the study.
Okay. Yeah. There was an argument that he was making that the conflict that interested him, Bruner, was a conflict between these representational systems. So between the imagery that you have, the iconic part versus the perceptual part of what you end up seeing. For Piaget, those are all external to the system and really uninteresting. The place where you're going to find disequilibrium taking place is either within the structure, between two structures that developed in the case of décalage, or between information that's coming from the environment to the structure. The first one, the first type of the disequilibrium between structures that children have already developed, he called that organizational disequilibrium. And the kind between the structure and the environment, he called adaptational equilibrium. And disequilibrium and adaptation and organization were like the two main systems that he was talking about. Bruner talked about disequilibrium also as a mechanism of development for cognitive change, but he was talking about it in terms of disequilibrium between the different kinds of systems that he claimed, representational systems, that he claimed were the representational systems that people used to understand their environment. As I said, Piaget saw those as being rather external to the mental structure itself. So that was what the argument was about. It's a long story, and to make it a long and boring story short and boring, what I did was I simply did a rerun of what it is that Bruner had done, but I added parts to try and make it even more in line with what it was that Bruner thought was happening and or should be happening. The data were better explained by Piaget's theory than by Bruner's theory.
But just to make it concrete for us, were these conservation studies?
They're conservation studies. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I mean, one study I remember for the people who don't have this book quite so vividly in mind is kids were better at conservation when the pouring was done behind a screen, the Francois Frank study, right, because then there wouldn't be a clash between the acting and the perceptual thing where it looked bigger in one vessel than in the other.
Exactly. And then when you remove the screen, then the children now have, when you think about, if you imagine using the iconic representational system as to what's behind the screen, you're now using that representational system. When it's removed, you have the perceptual system, and then the two are in conflict with each other, and that was supposed to bring about change. Yeah, that's what it was then.
So even though you were in science education, you clearly had gone into cognitive developmental psychology, whether or not you thought of yourself that way.
Right. No, I did think of myself. Yeah.
And then your postdoctoral work, tell us a bit about that.
That was in developmental psychology, pure, plain, and simple.
And that was Jonas
Langer. Yeah, at Berkeley. That was 2 years of postdoctoral work. I'd gone to Israel prior. I'd made a decision I was going to move to Israel. When I went there, I saw that there was nobody in developmental psychology, really. So what I decided to do was to get as much as I could before I went off into the desert. And so I did this 2 years postdoctoral work, and it was absolutely a wonderful experience. And that's when I started learning about developmental psychology in a much broader sense, and not the way that I'd been thinking about it when I was doing my doctoral work.
I'm struck by the statement there was nobody in Israel who was a developmental psychologist, because I went into the field about the same time as you did, and I can remember my first SRCD meeting, that's the Developmental Psychology Group, where you could get all the people into a modest size room.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Denver in 1969, and now there are thousands and thousands of people. So the notion that a country like Israel, which probably now has dozens and dozens mm-hmm. of developmentalists, didn't have any is kind of a culture shock.
Maybe the closest was Yitzhak Schlesinger at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem,
language
acquisition.
Yeah.
That was the closest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So then off to Israel, and I worked in Israel in curriculum development, and I was doing my research there. In the beginning, because I didn't speak Hebrew, I just started writing theoretical papers, because there's no way of doing empirical work, because I couldn't do the research, and the people who were working with me, their English wasn't good enough for us to be able to really communicate for all the subtleties that you need for the work that had to be done. So I basically did a lot of theoretical work for the first several years.
But that may also be because of your mentor as a postdoc, because Jonas Langer is almost uniquely theoretically oriented for a developmental
Absolutely.
Psychologist.
Yeah.
Well, let me skip ahead a bit,
okay.
Because you have a very unusual unit that you've been running for many years. I don't know of anyone that's like it, even outside of Israel. Why don't you tell us a bit about the group that you work with and what its goals are?
Yeah. The group is just a collection of people who are from Tel Aviv University, from various departments. So we have people in the psychology department, education department, linguistics, medical school, the Department of Comparative Literature and Poetry, people who whose interests are basically interests around cognitive development or around development. And we have weekly meetings, and we have people coming in. It's sort of an unusual group of people who I organize to come in all the time. Yuval Neyman, who's a physicist, worked with Murray Gell-Mann on the quark, and he talked to us, and just an example, talked to us about the concept of phylogenesis and biological evolution from the point of view of a physicist. Chagai Netzer, the development of the universe as an astrophysicist. Aleph Bet Yehoshua, A.B. Yeah, I'll tell you later. A.B. Yehoshua, or Joshua, I don't know how it's pronounced in English. Talking about the development of his latest novel and the work that he's doing in the future. So we have Yossi Israeli, theater director, the history of theater, the development of theater.
But just now, speaking, this is just sort of like Sid's friends. So what makes it the cognitive development unit of the Tel Aviv?
Sid's friends, the people who are from the university who are interested in these issues. Absolutely nothing bring these people together except for their interest in issues related to development. And there's a place where there's a sane 2 hours every week where there's excellent discussion with really interesting people who are in fields that are not really in a narrow sense related to developmental psychology. But in a very broad sense, they're absolutely central to issues around developmental psychology. And what development is just how do people in other domains who are looking at developmental issues, how do they conceptualize it? What are the kind of problems that they run into?
So when you're using developmental now, you're really using it in kind of a Clark University sense,
right.
Which translate means development is not how do children get from one stage to another, but how do you look at any sphere of human activity, from creating a novel to creating the universe, in terms of developmental kinds of concepts like differentiation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what happens is that everybody takes away whatever it is they take away from each of the lectures and the discussions that we have. But it's really, I find it the best 2 hours of the week.
It actually reminds me of something that I cut my teeth on around the same time, which was Bruner Center for Cognitive Studies, which was at Harvard for about 10 years, and it was Jerry and George's friends, but for people who went to it regularly, it was a an expansive education. Nonetheless, having presented to your group at various times over the last 20-odd years, they do know how to ask a lot of questions about psychology. So at some point, they do seem to have to go through the paces.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And the idea is, again, is to broaden our knowledge about developmental issues, where you begin to see developmental issues cropping up in other areas. Mm-hmm. They're just, most people are not exposed to it or don't read about it, and they're not professionals in those particular areas.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question now, which, unlike some of the others, I have no idea how you'll answer it. I mean, if I were teaching developmental psychology 25 years ago, many of the people who I would assign would be the same people I would assign today, mm-hmm. namely Piaget, Vygotsky, Lilibet Werner, and then we do some more recent things, but it seems to me, from my perspective, one draws on the same wells, Bruner. But when you teach, how do you think about that issue? To what extent is it classics as opposed to, the current handbook and the people who are now the same age as those people were 40 years ago?
Right. No, I'm still a classics person, and I think that in order to be able to understand anything that's happening which is new, I'm not sure how new it is, but anything which is happening which is new, you have to know what the ancestors said and thought. And it wasn't just Piaget and Bruner and all of them. Obviously, you can go back to the Greek philosophers as well. So it isn't as if in the last 100 years, people invented the questions. It's just that they came up with certain kinds of answers that they were allowed to come up with because they were in the 1900s as opposed to 3,000 years.
But they also had methods. In fact, probably that's the major accomplishment, is that you could actually do a study to decide whether Bruner or Piaget was more right. That was not an option 150 years ago.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a bit about what you are personally working on now in the year 2000.
Well, if you let me, I'll talk to you about some of the things that I've done in the past, and I'll talk about what I'm doing now also. When I came to Israel, and after about maybe 5 years or so, some people came to me in a science curriculum development unit that was developing curricula for elementary school science.
Now, these are national things. I mean, yes. In this country, nowadays, the government doesn't do much curriculum, but in Israel, it's national.
Yeah, in Israel, it's only that. Mm-hmm. So you can have two or three curricula in the sciences, and it's all done from government, out of government funds, which means that there's no profit, and the people who are pushing for whatever it is that they're pushing...
I thought Israel was filled with profits.
Yes, I think it was Ben Gurion who said that when he spoke to Truman, that it was very difficult to be Truman said it was very difficult to be a president of maybe 150 million people at that time. And Ben Gurion said it's very difficult to be prime minister of a country with 3 million prime ministers, so something like that. So some people came to me with a problem that children weren't solving a particular kind of a problem, task. And they couldn't understand why. So I gave a really wonderful solution to the problem, told them, do this and this and do that, whatever. Come back, I'm sure everything will be okay. They went out, came back 2 weeks later and said, no dice, it doesn't work. I couldn't imagine how it didn't work. So I spent about 10-12 years trying to figure out why it didn't work. And I did research with Stavi, Baruch Berkovich, Natan Orpaz, other people. And it has to do with something which I think might even be of importance or significance for what your class is about. It had to do with the concept of heat and temperature, and children's developing concepts of heat and temperature. So I brought my props, just to show people what it would look like. If we have, this is not a conservation task, although in some ways you could think of it as a conservation task. Some people have asked me about that. Let's say that we have two cups. Not let's say, we do have two cups, and let's say that they were filled with water, and we'll tell the kids that this is cold water here and cold water here, and they say fine, and then you pour the water into a third empty cup, and you ask the children, so what's the temperature here?
what we found was is that young children, about age 4 or 5, say, well, it's cold like it was before because it was cold and all you did was pour it. Older children, through about age 8, said it's twice as cold now because you have twice the amount of water. And still older children said that they're the same temperature, all you did was pour it. It's true that there's more cold water, but it's not colder water. So, if I were to put this on the board, if this is the, you know, something very simple, just the percent correct solutions, judgments, let's say, and this is age, let's say 4, 8, 12. We took the whole range of ages and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of children. So what you find is what's called the U-shaped behavioral growth curve. Okay, so that was unusual. Other people had seen U-shaped behavioral growth curves before, but it was mostly understood as growth errors, problems, methodological issues. You did something wrong, the children, and all sorts of things. But nobody really paid much attention to why it would be happening. Like, is there anything interesting to say about it other than growth errors? Now, let's take the same task. You take the water, you pour it back, and you pour it into these two containers. And now you take a thermometer, and you put it in here, and it measures, say, 10 degrees centigrade, which is cold. It would be in Fahrenheit. 32 is freezing. Let's say 42. Make it 45. Make it easier. So this is 45 degrees. This is 45 degrees. You pour it together, and you ask the children, what's the temperature? Most of the children will tell you that it's 90 degrees, because 45 and 45 is 90. And that's the case until about age 10. So what you find is, so something like this. Now, if you look at the problem, the task is the same task, same water, same manipulations. Nothing is different about them in terms of the physics. Yet we have two different kinds of learning curves, or developmental curves, however you want to look at it. So I got interested in why is it, what's the difference between the two kinds of tasks? So this task is the cold. That's the 45-45. So children understand the identical task in different ways depending upon the language in which it's couched. An everyday natural language, cold and cold. And if I were to be Vygotskian, I would say a cultural social an epistemological distinction that it makes between spontaneous knowledge or natural knowledge versus cultural social knowledge. This would be more like, cultural social, because you're talking about numbers, you're talking about degrees, you're using an artifact, a thermometer. So children understand the same task in different ways. And we see because there are different curves. Now, in a curriculum that was developed at Tel Aviv University, children were given tasks like 45 and 45. They would measure the water. This is 45, this is 45. You pour the water together. They all think it's going to be 90 degrees. You put the thermometer in, and it turns out that it's 45 degrees. Children's response was the thermometer is broken. So you give them a second thermometer. 45 degrees, 45 degrees. You pour it together, 45 degrees, two in a row. Three in a row. Why did I wake up in the morning? What is this? You know, everything is wrong. I mean, I know it has to be 90. It can't be 45. So when you have, in this case, when you have information coming from the environment that gives you an objective read of something which you're not too sure that you know what it is, 45 and degrees, it's not convincing enough to the cognitive system because the child knows that 45 and 45 is 90. You can just add and you know that it will come to 90. So people who used just measuring the temperature in the curriculum units in science classes, turns out that it was a dismal failure. So I started playing around with what happens if you ask it children the same question, but not with numbers, but now just talking about it in natural language, cold and cold, hot and hot, etc. Now, what happens is that there's at different ages you find children who are contradicting themselves. So the same child will say, cold and cold is cold, and 45 and 45 is 90. And you can ask him what's going on. Now the child is contradicting himself. It isn't that the world is contradicting what he knows. He's contradicting himself. So if you ask children at different ages about the conflict, we found many ways that children try to resolve the conflict.
By the way, is that a Brunnerian or a Piagetian conflict, according to the terms of your thesis?
I think it's Piagetian. I don't think Brunner really talked about it that way, although there's a way of couching it in Brunnerian terms. So younger children, when shown the, in the face of a conflict, didn't recognize that there was a conflict. Now I'll tell you how Israeli kids talk to experimenters. They say, well, I don't know what your problem is, but cold and cold is cold, and 45 and 45 is 90. So what's the problem here? Older kids who for a long time had thought that cold and cold is cold, which is correct, when they were in this conflictual situation, said, oh my God, of course, I could have done that. What a mistake. Cold and cold is very cold. So now the children, right, so the children who were right for a long time, when their correct, natural, let's say, if I use Vygotsky's understandings, were now in conflict with numbers and how the numbers went. The kids gave up the natural understanding and the correct understanding in a second. And then he asked them, well, wait a second, 45 and 45 is 90. Is 90 colder than 45? Is it the same temperature as 45? Is it colder than 45? And the children would say, oh, yeah, so 45 and 45 is minus 90. So they got them moving in the same direction. Cold and cold is very cold, and 45 and 45 is minus 90. So it's a not bad solution to get out of the problem. And yet older children, at approximately age 11, 12, resolved the conflict by saying, of course, it must be 45 and 45 is 45. I got interested in why in the world any child would ever say that, because in school, 45 and 45 is 90. Why would they ever say that it's 45? It's also a very long story, which I won't make long, but I think what happened was there's some kind of a mini-revolution in children's thinking about numbers as a notational system for temperature, another language that's being used, but the numbers that the child is using are now numbers that are modeling what's happening in the physics. If you say to a child 45 gallons and 45 gallons and you pour them together, he'll tell you they're 90. The same child will now tell you that 45 degrees and 45 degrees remains 45 degrees, which means that he's asking himself, what is the physics here? Do I add or do I not add? Is this a non-additive, even though I'm combining, joining, mixing, I'm not going to add the numbers. So the child has to understand what the physics is, and then he uses the appropriate arithmetic to try and describe what the physics system is. So we amended the curriculum unit based on the research that we did. I'm just giving, obviously, a very fast pass at it. It's much more complicated, and it's a lot deeper as well.
What did you do to the curriculum to open up the possibility of these two different ways of using number?
Well, to be very, very specific and just, you know, down to the nitty-gritty of what it looked like, the curriculum, about this particular problem that I talked about. Yeah. I mean, I've got many, many that I could talk about, but this is one of them. The children were asked to make judgments about on a scale, on a line between hot and cold, where the water, what the temperature was going to be, if it started off at cold and cold. Yeah. And then there was another line, and this was a thermometer, from 0 to 100, centigrade system. And then the child was to mark what happens when you pour them together. And then you ask the child to compare the two markings they had made, and then to see if it makes sense.
So you created essentially a notational system which made very vivid and concrete their takes on those two different ways of... One thing which occurred to me, which must have occurred to you and others, is let's say you were actually going to manipulate the displays so that the kids would touch something and find that, in fact, it had gotten warmer. It would seem to me that even younger kids ought to be very surprised by that. Has anyone done that?
What do you mean when it got warmer?
You've got cold, you pour it together in here, but by some kind of a trick, you actually have warmer.
Oh.
Well, what Bruno would call it an act of representation.
Okay. By a trick. I thought you thought that cold became warmer. And then I was
Well, that's why I'm the interviewer.
Well, what would kids do? My guess is I've actually done something like that, but not with this, with something else. That the kids would probably end up trying to describe what they thought shouldn't take place in physical terms like friction, that the water when you were pouring it got hotter because it rubbed up against. These are the sorts of things that you can expect kids to say. I don't think that it would be, it would be surprising because this isn't what they expected. But I don't think that as a result of this kind of a trick that that children would change the way that they think about things.
Yeah. Now, I was actually asking a slightly different question, which was really, would they be surprised if they were then handed the thing and it was significantly warmer?
Yes, I think they would be surprised. But I think they would have a ready answer.
Right.
I did something like that once where in conservation kind of tasks, where children, we had balls that were put on a balance scale, and they were the same weight. You took them off, and you rolled one out, and unbeknownst to the child, you took off a little bit.
The Smedsland's
chance. And then the child says they're going to be the same weight. You put it on, and they're not the same weight. And then you ask the child to explain. And usually the explanations were not that they reverted to non-conservation. They talked about the balance and how the balance works.
Mm.
Right. So I think in that kind of, they were surprised, but they had an explanation. Mm. I think it would be something similar.
Mm. Well, it must be a very gratifying experience to discover something about the psyche and to actually have it translated into curricula which get used. You told me 60% of students are using curricula that you've devised.
Right. Yeah. So it's I must say that when you do your research, it's always great and fun. When you try and take some of the ideas, if you can, and put them to use and for the education of children, and 60% of the children in your country are studying from this material, the responsibility is a lot different than the responsibility that you have when you're doing your research. Your responsibility is of another nature altogether.
How many of the students who study with you actually go and work in curricular units for the government? Is it a significant proportion?
No, actually, the students who are PhD students who are working with me now are basically teaching in colleges.
So they don't go and work for the government in most cases?
Yeah, in most cases not. There's one woman who's the chief superintendent for the country for English education, English as a second language. Mm-hmm. So she's in the government. But other than that, the other students who are working with me are university and college types.
Now, you know, and students in the course also know, that a lot of the controversy now about children's understanding of science and developmental psychology focuses around biology. Have you yourself worked in biology on the notion of what it means to be alive and things like that?
Mm-hmm. No.
So you stuck to the physical and chemical end of things.
Right. Until I switched over to something else, which was teacher's cognition.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay. So I've been doing that for a while. Actually, it's one of the few times where I made a decision that I was going to do something, and I actually did it. I decided about a decade ago that I was not going to work on anything except for teacher's cognition. And everything that interested me that pulled me in different directions, which in my former life, I would go in all these different directions. I decided that I would be more focused than I normally am and started working in teacher's cognition. And the idea is that the claim is that teachers teach with some kind of an understanding, called a mental model, and the reasons why it's that. Teachers have mental models, the psychological entity that I claim is in people's minds, teachers' minds, about how children, what the mind looks like, and how learning takes place in it. And that's what guides how people teach, and that's what guides how people speak about how they teach. So that's the main...
And we're talking here about teachers of elementary students, or high school, or...
University, kindergarten, parents teaching their children to tie shoes, babysitter.
So it's folk theories, or not so folk theories, of learning.
Right. And I think it's very folk theories.
Understanding.
Yeah. I give you an anecdote about some of this, so you might appreciate it. We had a potential donor, actually somebody we both know, to Tel Aviv University, and that was supposed to be, maybe, he was going to be donating money for the establishment of a center for the study of learning. So the university pulled out the big guns, and there were actually a bunch of tutorials that were given to this particular person, and there was somebody who talked about how computers learn, top-down model. And somebody else talked about how learning takes place giving a biochemical description of learning at the level of the neuron, differences between short-term and long-term memory at the biochemical level. Someone who was a philosopher was talking about different kinds of learning. And then it was my turn, not as a big gun, but somebody who knew the person who was the potential donor, who I remind you we both know well. And one of the things that I noted was that all the people who are speaking have expertise in learning. Everybody presented a different model of learning, which is what you'd expect. Yet everybody taught the same way. So even though everybody were professional scientists working on issues related to learning, that was their field of expertise. When they taught, which revealed their folk psychology understanding of learning, they taught in the same way. There's really no difference between them in the way that I look at what it was that they were trying to do.
And what you're really saying is they have the same epistemology.
Right. They have the same understanding, or mental model is what I call it, of the mind and how learning takes place in the mind. So even people who are really, this is their life's work. They get up in the morning, they run to their labs to do their work on learning. But when it comes to what their folk psychology understanding of learning was, they were indistinguishable.
Yeah, and you should tell us what that model is now.
Okay. So... by the way, just as an aside, we didn't get the money.
Well, then it could be lots of people whom we know.
Yes, there's a lot of finger pointing. So the mental model, actually there's another distinction that should be made, and there's a distinction between when people speak about how it is that they teach and when they actually teach. Because those are two different epistemological systems, and I wouldn't expect them to be very similar. Although there are a lot of people who say things like, you know, people do one thing and they say something else. Well, you know, what's new? People are human beings. But I don't think that's really the right way to talk about it, or an interesting way to talk about it. The question is, what is the epistemological system that you have when you speak about teaching, which underlying that is an understanding of what learning is, and what is the epistemological system that underlies when you're actually your actual teaching, which again has underlying it a conception of the mind and how it is that learning takes place. I'll tell you about the espoused type, because it's easier to in this kind of a format to describe. We ask teachers, and not just teachers, questions like, you know, there's always something that's difficult when you're teaching. All the children don't grasp everything immediately. Is there something that's difficult for everybody in some subject at some time? And without saying exactly what the content was, we just simply ask people what makes this material difficult, and how do you teach to help the children overcome the difficulties that they're having? And so teachers say things like, and again, not only teachers, say things like, I see you're looking, so you're probably thinking what you would have said. So I'll tell you what I think you'll probably say. You'll probably say, difficult material is abstract. So if I make it more concrete, whatever that means, it'll be easier. If the material is complex, it'll be difficult for them to understand. So I'll break it up into parts. Difficult material is if the children don't have prior knowledge about the content that we're talking about, it will be difficult for them. So then they have to either rely on other knowledge that they have using analogies, similes, whatever, to get them to understand it better, to have them connect the new material to what they already know. If I can't do that, I can drive it into memory through repetition, through drill. Some children are, let's say that they're better when they see things and more visual. You like these. Some are more, let's say, auditory, so individual differences. I try to use all the senses because I'm not sure who likes what, what works with whom. So I use all the senses to get them engaged in the material. Sometimes when I'm teaching and children aren't really grasping the ideas, it's because I'm not very clear in the way that I'm teaching. Maybe I don't understand it as well as I should. It's not well organized, the material that I'm presenting. And on. This is an hour and a half interview. And then we say, okay, so this is what the teachers are saying. And these are the sorts of statements that teachers make. And they all sound reasonable, but the question we ask is, if somebody says these things, any of those, what must be giving rise to those statements? Why would somebody say that? What's the system that's guiding or constraining those statements? Because you're not going to say just any old thing. Only certain statements are allowable. So the question is, what's the constraining system? What sets the limits on what can be said? And what won't you say? What's outside, what's off limits. And then the description that you make of what it is that people do say, and I say what they can say, is this mental model that they have of what the mind is like and how learning takes place. The mental model has sort of an engineering vision. This is the espoused when people speak about it, not when they actually teach. It has an engineering vision in it. And knowledge exists outside of the mind. It's usually in the teacher's mind, or it's in books, or it's in the parent's mind, or it's in CD-ROMs, but it's not in the child's mind. If it was in the child's mind and it was okay, so you don't have to teach it because it's there. So the moment you have knowledge which is outside of the mind and you want it to get into the mind, then you have an engineering problem of how do you get it in. And then once it gets in, how do you get it to the final resting place where the glue is? And if you think about it, when you teach, it's sort of like in physics, there's this action at a distance. Well, in psychology, there's action. In teaching, there's action at a distance. You can't physically, obviously, enter anybody's mind. All you can do is talk or ask people to do things. And when we talk or we ask people to do things, we assume, hope, that what it is that we're asking them to do and what it is that we're saying and the way that we're saying is it is going to cause learning to take place in somebody else's mind. And that's the one of the parts of the of what I'm trying to do is to capture what the nature of this mental model is that that includes notions of got it in Hebrew, not in English. intentionality on the part of the teacher, notions of what cognition is. How do you know that somebody's learned? Right? You want to bring about learning, but how do you know that it actually happened? What are the kind of tests or probes that you use, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an engineering vision of getting the knowledge in the mind. And then, once it's in the mind, moving it along so that it can get connected to or hooked up to what the children already know. And again, doing it outside of somebody else's mind. Trying to manipulate what's happening in the mind, not in a negative sense, so that learning can take place. So that it's probably too general of a way of describing it for the purposes here, but I can go into more detail. But that's the sense of.
But the point is, you get a story like this from people in a whole range of teaching roles. Is that correct?
Kindergarten teachers through full professors at universities.
And as I recall, it doesn't really matter whether they've studied cognitive development.
That's right.
Whether they've taken your course.
That's right.
You don't, there's no particular revolution.
None. So
must be right then, if everybody agrees.
Thank God for something. Now, it turns out that the courses that we teach, at the university, in teacher education courses, don't make a bump on anything that the teachers have in terms of their profound understandings, albeit unconscious, non-reflective, non-aware understandings of what the mind and learning takes place.
Tony, you probably have not seen the afterword that I've written to the paperback edition of The Disciplined Mind. In The Disciplined Mind, I attacked a view which was kind of like your engineering view, of E.D. Hirsch, who is a well-known theorist in this country, who basically promotes what he calls cultural literacy or core knowledge, which is, so to speak, the information kids should learn at each grade. So he's got whatever second grader should know, whatever third grader should know. And I thought I did a pretty good job of showing the weakness in this. But when the book came out, it was quite clear to me that people are very deeply Hirschian, just like they're very deeply and deeply these engineering views. So I created The Tale of the Two Barns, which I think maybe is only two developmental psychologists would have come up with. But the first barn I call the empiricist barn. And the empiricist barn is basically empty at birth. And the purpose is to put as much stuff into that barn as quickly as possible. And if you have a lot of stuff in the barn, it passes what I call cultural literacy. Then the other barn I call the constructivist barn. And now this is Howard Gardner speaking rather than developmental psychology. The constructivist barn, very early in life, begins to develop what I call furniture. And this is what you would call theories or conceptions and misconceptions. And some of the furniture is quite serviceable, but a lot of it is erroneous. It's like the hot and hot makes hotter kinds of things. So I say a large part of early education is raising the barn, R-A-Z-I-N-G, getting rid of that furniture, braiding it, in a sense, dissolving the misconceptions, and then constructing, which is why I call it a constructivist, better furniture, which would be the actual scientific, biological, psychological theories and so on. And I go on to argue that when you begin to develop this furniture, fact rather than being free-floating, as they were until then, congregate in the appropriate barn, but because appropriate furniture, but because the furniture has a semi-permeable membrane, you can actually connect the furniture so you can do work that involves more than one discipline. The problem is right or wrong, this is incredibly complicated, and it's much easier to believe in the empiricist barn. The big mystery for Hirsch is how do you go from facts to disciplines? And I guess that your issue is, you call it the glue issue, but how would the stuff know where to go and how to be used? And there's probably no theory that people have of that, except it may be a natural resting place. I like that metaphor.
I think I'm going to take issue with the raising part that you talked about.
Okay.
I don't think you can really do something significant with the with people's everyday intuitions. I think they remain. I don't think you can obliterate them. I think that they will still be there. What you have to do is to find a way for, I think, people to be reflective about what his intuitions are that they don't know that they have. So part of what you have to do then, this is developmental theory, and say cognitive developmental theory in terms of teacher education, but not just teacher education, be with kids as well, to help people become aware of the knowledge that they have, of the conceptions that they have, and then to propose alternatives to what it is that they're thinking. Because I don't think that there's any way of getting rid of the misconceptions, or however you want to call them. By the way, I don't think there is such a thing as a misconception in the sort of work I'm doing now in teacher's cognition, because nobody really knows. Here's this big secret. Nobody really knows what learning is. Right.
So misconception implies there's a better conception.
That's right. The miss means that it's off,
yeah.
But there's something which is accepted. Yeah. Well, there's nothing accepted.
Yeah.
And we as teachers, or we as faculty members, say to people, well, we really don't know what learning is. Or there are 50 different understandings of learning. Well, go off and help children learn.
Right.
That's one of the things. One of the charges that we give to people when they leave. Cause learning in others is a psychological causality notion implicit in what it is that we're asking people to do, yet we can't describe to them really what it is that this thing is that they're supposed to bring about, because we don't know what it is.
Yeah. Well, we know that people do learn, but it may well be despite what we do, or rather in parallel to what we do. And what I would actually say on this this apparent disagreement about whether you can raise the theories R-A-Z-E, I don't believe they get raised in the sense that they disappear forever,
mm-hmm.
because we know when you get older and more senile and so on, those early ways of thinking return. So presumably they're there at some level. But I think what one develops, whether or not one ever has the kind of meta-awareness of the erroneous theories, is just other moves to make which bypass those early theories. So there's no need for them to be evoked anymore. Mike Connell, the teaching fellow, who is our expert in neural nets and on parallel distributed processing and so on, would probably think in terms of, you just have new kinds of settlings which are adequate, and so the older theories don't get accessed anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, it's moot whether they really disappear, as long as they don't cause problems.
Right.
They can be, they're kind of in purgatory for a while. But I'm struck, given the difficulty I have in putting forth my little theory, and the fact that whether they're teaching babies or graduate students, and people have the same basic engineering theories of learning, how deep, how robust these views of education are. And of course, they can't be completely wrong, but they're very naive. They're very unsophisticated. There's lots they can't explain.
Well, ask me. I'll ask you. I'll switch and I'll be the interviewer for a second. When you were in China, in what we're talking about now, did you think that or find anything which looked different than this engineering view that we're talking about? Talking about another culture. And,
right. I think that there are different views of learning in China than there are in the West. They're no more coherent.
Mm-hmm.
But among the things that I noticed were the following. Even more of a belief than we have in the United States, though it's gotten worse in the United States, that prenatal kinds of things can have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
I've ran into that over and over and over again. A belief in what Jacqueline Goodnow calls error-free learning, that you can shape so that errors and misconceptions never even arise, and kind of a super Skinnerian view, if you will, only positive reinforcement, only molding to get basically a view that performance is all, and a kind of an expressed uninterest in deeper understanding. The important thing is to be able to do things and to carry them out, and what's going on internally, if there's anything internal, is not an issue at all. You talk about if all else fails, rote. That's how it starts. Now, I'm talking about China in 1980, and it may be different now. I mean, most classic exchange I had with a Chinese teacher, which American teachers will recognize, but this was a college psychology course, and the subject was memory and attention. And there were five rules of memory and attention. And it was written on a blackboard, it was in a textbook, and the entire class was spent repeat those five rules of memory and attention. And I was being driven nuts. So I finally afterwards talked to the teacher, who was a quite sophisticated person. I said, you know, I don't understand. You have it in the textbook. Everybody's reciting. It's on the blackboard. Why do you waste your time having everybody recite it? I mean, why don't you ask them to do something with it, do something new? And we argued for about 10 minutes.
And she finally said to me, you know, we've been doing it so long this way, we know it's right. And
the answer is, I don't think there's a view that's refreshingly different from the engineering view, but I think there's even more of a molding, don't let anything go wrong, a point of view which, again, to simplify, goes back to the learning of characters, which is, I mean, Chinese, I mean, you have thousands of characters, is what you do when you're young. It's a big deal. Right. And so you sit there and you perfectly copy them over and over and over again until you get them totally assimilated, so it's like second nature. And I think that colors all the kind of the teaching that takes place. On the other hand, as we know, the kids have a much better mathematics performance than they do in the United States, at least at the better schools. So there is some understanding taking place, but it's not coming about because they are constructivists rather than empiricists or engineers. I'm conscious that we've already talked about an hour, but I want to ask you, is there anything I should have asked you or anything that you would like to mention either about the work we talked about, the more recent stuff on teachers' conceptions or the earlier stuff on U-shaped curves and kids' understanding of intensive and extensive measures that...
No, not really. I mean, in the end, I could either broaden it and put it into philosophical perspectives. I can go into details about experiments, the sort of work that we're doing. Anybody who's interested, you'll tell them how they can get in touch with me. What you didn't ask
email.
Right. What you didn't ask me was, do you want to have coffee afterwards?
I'm going to ask you one other question, though, and you may not have an answer to this, but I don't want to miss the opportunity to ask you. Having been in developmental psychology now for a long time, we count by decades now, what do you think are the most exciting ideas or work in the last few years that, you know, if you said, Howard, you know, there's one person's work or one line of work, whether it's from biology or artificial intelligence or neural networks or whether it's being done in your own lab or somewhere else, where you say, you know, this is really where I think this field is going to get its energy from next, or if you were to organize one of those classic Sidney Strauss symposia, of which there are many volumes, who would you want to invite to talk about what?
So the hoop is another story. What would it be about? Like, I think in the end, the deep developmental questions that organize theory in developmental psychology, I don't think they've changed. The answers that we give to the questions have changed, but the questions still remain the same. And I think that's absolutely crucial. That's why I'm always with the classics, because I think that those were the people who knew how to ask the questions and frame them in interesting ways. I think that I think that Sue Carey's work, you mentioned about what does it mean to be alive, for instance. I think in the end, most of it comes down to what are the questions you're asking? What is the nature of this cognitive, psychological, whatever you want to call it, entity that you claim is in people's minds? And what are the mechanisms of development that you describe that allow you to get from one kind of a system to the next system? Now, the way you describe, I think those are really the kinds of questions that people are asking. If they're not, I think they should be asking. Maybe add one or two. What is the infant born with? Right? Because I think the moment you make a claim as to what the infant comes into the world with, you'll know 80% of the rest of what the person is going to say. Right? You make this argument, then the other things are going to flow from that. And there's no way of getting around it unless you're going to find yourself in deep philosophical problems that you don't want to get into. So you know pretty much what somebody's going to say the moment they tell you about what the child's born with. And also the relationship between learning and development. Those are like fundamental questions that people ask. But most important, what does the person want to know? What is the deep, what is the main question that the person is asking? Piaget wanted to know, where does novelty come from? Vygotsky was asking, what makes us different from other animals? And those were, and then from there, other things started to move.
So if I can summarize, Sid, put a few words in your mouth. If you read Socrates via Plato, Aristotle, and Goethe, and you either went to a few SRCD meetings or read the most recent handbook, you'd be up to date.
Right.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming and spending time with us, and people will be watching this for some years to come.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. And thank you.
Hope the handshake takes